Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bjorkman, Judge Wheelock, Judge Jessen, the Honorable Louise Dovery Bjorkman presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. You will notice that we do not have Judge Wheelock present this morning. She is not available, but she will be listening to these arguments, the audio recordings, and will fully participate in the deliberative process. And good morning again. Today is October 2nd, 2024. We have four matters on the calendar for oral argument this morning. The first is Peggy Flagg et al. Versus Civil Society. Counsel, you will each have 15 minutes to make your argument. Counsel for appellants, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal also. As I mentioned, we are making an audio recording. That is the only recording allowed of this hearing today. So it's important that you state your name and identify your party you represent when you begin your argument. With that, counsel for appellants, you may proceed.
Well, good morning, Your Honors. Ms. Flagg is here with me as well. She's seated over there. And we thank you for the opportunity for oral argument. My name is Timothy Shields, and I am one of the plaintiffs and the appellants, along with Ms. Flagg. I want to make sure that we get this out right away, that appellants support the lower court's legal decision that states, and I quote from the July 27, 2023 order, quote, in this matter, the existence of the contracts between the parties and each contract's terms are not in dispute. We support and agree with that.
And there's no argument that any of the provisions are ambiguous.
Well, you took the words right out of my mouth, Your Honor. I was going to say, and further, we support the lower court's conclusion that the parties' legal duties are governed by express contract. And I agree with what the court just said. However, we do not agree that this contract contains a condition precedent in any way, shape, or form, and that if it did, that would be void against public policy. But since, you know, we sued, we alleged these contracts, we attached them to the complaint, and the court found them to be enforceable express contracts with all the written terms the court talks about, they're expressed, they're written out for everybody to see. We just have a problem with the interpretation and this finding of this sort of implied or expressed, however the court determined it, condition precedent. I also want to note that this lower court ruling finding the contracts came on respondent's 1203 motion, and in that it argued the plaintiffs are suing for breach of a non-existent contract. But the trial court, the district court, rejected that and said these contracts are in existence, are valid, are enforceable, and their terms are expressed. And I think by that, the court meant, and I would mean that there's not like oral parole evidence or something that was varying them. What's on the paper is the contracts.
So if I may, and of course we are looking at this de novo as far as the contract construction, right? I'm looking at paragraph 2 of the employment contracts, which starts out saying, you know, these contracts end on September 30th. But then there is this language that you point us to towards the end of that paragraph. Mm-hmm. So my question when we're trying to construe this contract is whether that phrase that starts within such 30-day termination period, wouldn't it be a reasonable interpretation that everything after that in paragraph 2 is basically explains what can happen within the 30-day termination period, which is, would you agree with that interpretation?
Yes, until you get down, further down in that paragraph, Your Honor, that paragraph, two-term paragraph on page 2 for the record, it talks about if cases cannot be transferred to another attorney because a judge or court refuses to release attorney from the attorney-client relationship, or the funding for this contract has ended. So there's two clauses there. The relationship between attorney and civil society will change to an hourly fee contract under which attorney will be paid $20.38 an hour for the duration of the case. And that is our position, that I understand you could say that within a such 30-day termination period, and I presume the court maybe means 30 days after the contract would end, but there really wouldn't, that wouldn't make much contractual sense, at least respectfully in my opinion, because why then would there be a provision about transferring to other lawyers and paying us and whatever?
One possibility might be, if you follow me, kind of looking at the first sentence of there. So the contract has this term that ends on September 30th, unless it's terminated earlier within 30 days prior written notice. So my question was, well, if we're looking at, so if we're looking at that earlier termination, that would be the 30-day termination period. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, and there are provisions in here for both the employees, the lawyers who were employees, you know, to quit or move on or whatever, and for civil society to fire or release for cause or non-cause those lawyers. And my view of that would be that that's when that 30-day part would be, that it would be under, you know, where someone's leaving their employment for whatever reason, quit or gets fired. And then during that 30 days, you know, the attorney shall, at civil society's option, since they're the employer, terminate or finalize all possible services, transfer all those materials and all that sort of stuff. But you still then get left with, well, what are you doing with the client in the case? And where is the client in all this? Where is the client's permission to change who they think is representing them?
Well, isn't that then where we get to the last sentence in paragraph 2, which addresses a situation where a case cannot be transferred, either because a court won't let the lawyer or because the fund can't be transferred because the court refuses to release their attorney, or the funding for this contract has ended. It seems to me those are two situations, one of which must exist for there to be any ongoing hourly fee contract. Do you agree with that reading of that last sentence?
One of those two things must happen?
Either the funding for the contract is ended, mm-hmm. or cases can't be transferred because of a court order declining to do so. That in one of those two, only in those two situations will this change into the hourly fee, 2038, hourly fee for the duration of the case.
Yes, Your Honor, we do agree with that.
And so it seems to me you don't allege that in the complaint, and therein lies the problem.
Well, but we do allege in paragraphs, and I can give you those, it's paragraph 11, I believe it starts on, and also in paragraph 23. In paragraph 11 in the complaint, appellant state, both plaintiffs are currently representing civil society qualified clients in continuing federal and state legal proceedings. And in paragraph 23, we say plaintiffs are continuing to provide professional legal services to their clients, furnishing valuable labor, material, and skill to the clients for which plaintiffs are entitled to full compensation from legal society. So I believe, and you know, we can get into the whole notice pleading and all that, but I think that does say that fits the bill here, and that we were representing clients. We've alleged that in the complaint. The court must take that as being a true statement under a Rule 1203 motion. And so then if the contract is ending, if the funding for the contract is ended, and that's a matter of fact that would be down in the district court, but if, let's say that that was true here, then this, we've alleged that we have these continuing cases, but they're their clients, not our clients, not the clients of Ms. Flagg and I. These were civil society clients, as the contract states. And so the question then becomes, do we have to continue to represent them? And that's where you get into the rub and the conflict with Rule 1.16 and of the Code of Professional Conduct and 1.3.
A lot of lot of the briefing has gone to what is our standard? What are we reviewing here? I mean, I know our standard of review is de novo, but is it your position we should be looking at the issue here, the sufficiency of the allegations through a Rule 12 lens or a Rule 56 lens?
Okay, my theory on that, and I think it's supported in the case law, and I'll answer that in a slightly different manner if I might. I think there's two, so yes, it's de novo review, it's a contractual review, et cetera, et cetera. But there are two places where I think you have two sort of ports of demarcation here. The first one is, did the lower court follow the rules and the law and the case law on how to decide a 1203 motion?
Why does that matter if our review is de novo? It isn't the difference between Rule 12 and Rule 56, the lens question I ask, really a difference between what the scope of the information we consider?
Well, that's true. But you could choose either or both. And under either or both, you can do a de novo review and reverse and remand or accept or whatever you want to do. Except that you get into, there's not a lot of facts because the record was never developed. But I think to the central question, which I think is the central question, is does this contract contain some sort of condition precedent that this corporation can foist onto its employee lawyers if it decides to shut down? That's the first question, and you can do that under a review under Rule 12 or Rule 56 if you think this was a motion for summary judgment. And then second of all, if you believe it contains that, is that ever appropriate in a contract where a company, a private company, is employing licensed Minnesota lawyers? And I don't need to go into all the examples that could exist on that, but they're myriad. So they, somehow without the client's permission to get, whether it's Rule 12 or Rule 56, you get, without the client's permission, they take a civil society client and give it to us somehow, and then now we, under the lower court's decision, we then have to do something with it pro bono without being paid.
But can't we, as the appellate court, say, look, we disagree with the district judge's analysis that there's a condition precedent, but we could construe this provision to say this employment agreement ends on September 30th, 2022, and that everything, as I tried to suggest earlier, probably not as artfully as I should have, everything after that phrase, within such 30-day termination period, is just if it had been, contract had been terminated before it did on September 30th. I mean, that's why I wanted you to address that, because that's something I'm struggling with, counsel.
No, I understand, Your Honor, it's an express contract, but these are somewhat ambiguous terms. But what happens to the client in the cases as a result of your question?
And so you're saying this is ambiguous. Is that your argument?
Well, if when you're looking at the whole paragraph and all this, yes, it is, because it fails to deal with the central question, which would, I mean, it's got $20.38, and it's got some dates in here and things. But what happens to the clients? What happens to their client? What happens to their lawyers? What happens to their representation? It's not answered in here. And nowhere does it say that while these cases get, number one, they get transferred to the individual lawyers, our employees, who we've now fired. You know, so they're not working for us anymore. And two, the only way that we're ever going to pay them, if we ever do, is that they've got to withdraw, or they've got to try to withdraw.
If I could ask a question on a different, move to a different point, there's been very little that you've put before us as far as this accrued vacation payout issue. When I looked at the transcript before the district court, I believe it was you that referenced, mm-hmm. You know, Minnesota Statute 181, but, you know, that wasn't pled. So I'm... you know, I see a difference between the sick leave, which, as I recall, and I'm sure you understand the record better than I do, there's a provision that says, well, sick leave isn't paid out at the end of at an employment termination. But it doesn't say anything about vacation accrual. So what would you have us, what would you point us to?
Well, we do allege in the complaint specific allegations concerning these employee benefits. Now, there is another document that is mentioned in here. It's some sort of employee handbook thing that I believe may be in the lower court record. But the court didn't address it, really. The lower court just said, well, we didn't plead any of this, but we did. But the contract itself, and it, you know, there's a lot of pages to this, but the contract itself talks about how the employees will be compensated for include mileage and seminars and this St. Paul program will be treated as an employee for purposes of federal insurance, FICA, Social Security. Attorney does qualify for designated attorney benefits that civil society may now hereafter provide to its attorneys, including without limitation, payments toward health insurance, mileage reimbursement, malpractice, and it kind of goes on and on. Now, again, some of that's ambiguous as to exactly what the benefits are. Like, you know, does someone get 30 days of PTO or something that we might be more familiar with in our regular lives? But certainly this contract talks about it, says we'll be employees, and we pled that.
All right. Counsel, your time has expired. Yes, you, and I know you
thank
were responding
you, and I know
to a
you're
question.
On a tight schedule. So.
Yeah, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. Chad Snyder on behalf of Civil Society. And I want to start with the question about the contract. Did it exist? Clearly, there was a contract between these parties. And by its unambiguous terms, as the trial court said in both of its orders, it ended on September 30th, 2022. And to go, Judge Jessen, to the question you were asking, is that the end of the analysis? That has been my position from the beginning of this case.
How does that analysis, your interpretation of the contract, square with what we all know is a lawyer's duty to a client that goes beyond their receiving payment for the work?
It squares with it, Your Honor, because lawyers leave law firms all the time, either because they are fired or because law firms close. Early in my career, there seemed to be a boom of law firms that were imploding in the Twin Cities, and those lawyers had clients, and those firms had clients, and the decisions had to be made. Rule 1.16 does not say that a lawyer is stuck with a client forever under all circumstances. If they are unable to continue the representation because of financial distress, for example, having lost the job that employed them to represent that client, they are allowed to withdraw. There is nothing unethical about withdrawing from representation, as long as you do it within the scope of Rule 1.16. And part of that may well be that a judge says, I can't let you out right now. Had that been pled in this case, we would be having a different argument. I'm not sure the language at the end of paragraph 2 still applies because, honestly, the contract had ended. The 30 days that we're talking about after, you know, everything after the termination on September 30th, 2022, relates to early termination of the contract before that termination date.
Mr. Snyder, and I believe it was you that was arguing before the district court.
But it was, Your
Honor. Okay. When I went and looked at that transcript, I believe you said there is a limited circumstance which allows for payment post-October 1st. And then you went to argue about why they didn't apply here, which kind of related back to your the condition precedent argument. But if there's a limited circumstances for a allows for payment post October 1st, doesn't that create an ambiguity? I mean, which, because that's not an absolute, which if you just looked at the first sentence of paragraph 2, I would agree with you. That's pretty absolute. But when there's this limited circumstance, does it apply, doesn't it? Seems like the sort of thing that perhaps would be ambiguous and we shouldn't be addressing on a motion to dismiss. Help me with that.
Certainly. I have two answers to that question, Your Honor. The first is a confession of a lawyer that in oral argument, new arguments were being presented and I was dealing with them on the fly. And so I don't entirely agree with the idea that anything after September 30, 2022 in paragraph 2 applies. We proceeded on that argument because for the first time in affidavits filed after I filed my reply brief, that language, the idea of that language was raised by the plaintiffs, by affidavits they filed, which converted this into a summary judgment motion. And so I made that argument, and I think this leads into the second piece of my answer to you, Your Honor. If that language at the end does apply to this circumstance, to a termination at the end of the contract, there isn't an ambiguity here because there is still a condition precedent. Mr. Shields just agreed that in order for the payment, for them to be entitled to payment under the end, at the end, that $20.38 at the end of paragraph 2, either the contract their contract has to have lost its funding, or they have to have been denied the right to withdrawal. Those are conditions precedent. Neither of those things has been alleged or alleged in either the complaint or in any of the affidavits that the plaintiffs submitted.
So you say that both that the complaint is inadequate, does not allege, make those allegations, and that there was no competent evidence that either one of those situations occurred, submitted to the extent this is a summary judgment analysis.
That is correct, Your Honor.
If I may.
Yes.
Going back to this last phrase in paragraph 2, one of my questions, which gets me to another point of is this ambiguous or not, is does this $20.38 an hour mean paid as a continued employee, as a contract? I mean, isn't even that question pointing to some ambiguity? Because it's not clear to me. What's your take on that, sir?
That's not a question I've really considered before now. But here's my answer, at the risk of making up an answer on the spot. What it says is that it will change to an hourly fee contract. That does not sound like an employment arrangement to me, Your Honor. That sounds like the arrangement I have with my clients. They pay me on an hourly fee basis, but it is, in this case, it would be being paid by a third party.
That sort of question just makes me think, is that even some ambiguity where we should go back and then let there be some discovery on the intent of the parties, particularly as it relates to this vacation payout, which if you would address at some point, I would appreciate that as well.
I will, Your Honor, but I want to go back to that ambiguity question because even if it is an ambiguity, I do not believe it matters to the resolution of this case because we don't get to were they employees or not after the termination of the contract unless the condition precedent has been met. And there is neither allegation nor evidence that the condition precedent has been met. There has never been a claim made that either Mr. Shields or Ms. Flagg sought and was denied the opportunity to withdraw from any of their cases. Ms. Flagg states in her affidavit that she felt she'd made the choice to continue representing her clients, which is admirable. She was doing important work. I'm glad she did it. But I've been in the same position. When I left a law firm 20 years ago, they were paying me to do pro bono work. I couldn't go to that firm and say, hey, I don't actually have any work yet, but I'm going to need you guys to pay me while I do this pro bono work that you were paying me to do. I made that choice.
Well, what about the second condition precedent, if we're going to use that phrase. The funding for the contract is ended. Mm-hmm. Isn't that exactly the situation here?
No, because this contract had ended. This contract ended on September 30th, 2022. There could have been a new contract if new funding had been provided. But this contract ended. They did not lose, you know, or stop paying Mr. Shields and Ms. Flagg and all of the other employees because the grantor said in September of 2021, the money's dried up, we're not going to pay you. The contract ended. And so that language
not
is irrelevant.
Not the funding. Your position is the contract ended, not the funding.
Yes. A new contract would have had to have been entered if they were going to continue going forward. And that turned out not to be an option. Do you want to address the vacation question? As the Fresenius and the KT, I can't remember the name of one of the stations, the case law on vacation and sick pay is very clear that it is a matter of contract. And so that if there were going to be a right for payment of unused vacation pay, there would need to be a contractual term that created that right. There isn't one. There is not one in the employment contract itself or in the employee manual, which was Exhibit 4 to the Swisher affidavit, which is incorporated into paragraph 3 of the employment contract. What there is a requirement that if you're going to get paid for vacation pay, you have to give 30 days notice of when you're taking that pay, or that vacation, rather, and it has to be approved. Absent a term that gives a right to post-termination or on-termination payment of unused vacation pay, there is no right to it. And there is no allegation that either of these plaintiffs was not paid for vacation pay or sick leave that they did use. And in fact, there is in Ms. Swisher's affidavit an affirmation that everybody was paid for the time that they asked for. In the end, Your Honor, what we have here is a contract that ended. And employees who are asking for a right to continue that contract, to continue payment under that contract, because they chose to continue to do the work. Their obligation to civil society ended on September 30th, 2022. They chose to continue to do work, good work for people, but they made that choice. Civil society shut down. It was in no position to pay anybody. And as soon as this case is resolved, it will finish its dissolution process. But this is what is holding it up. In the absence of an ongoing contract, in the absence of a condition precedent that would allow for the extraordinary remedy of post-termination payment, there is no claim here, and the complaint was properly dismissed.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Shields, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm just going to really quickly address your vacation question, Judge Jessen, Justice Jessen. I keep hearing there's nothing in the contract and there's nothing in our complaint about this. Page 2, paragraph 3, right underneath the section we've been talking about, says, payment. Civil society will pay attorney, and then it's that FTE is variable, plus a 10% bonus to be paid biweekly, plus funds under Earned Sick and Safe Time, ESST, on a yearly basis as long as that ordinance is in effect, the St. Paul ordinance, for services to be performed under this contract. So it's in the contract. Second of all, our complaint says in paragraph 15, defendant may owe plaintiff for bonuses, unpaid sick time, vacation time, and other reimbursements. Third, if you do take this on a Rule 56 summary judgment, which is not what the district court considered, you will find attached to my affidavit an email from this office person at Civil Society saying that they owe me 410 hours or something like that. I was never paid that. Now, that's putting facts into the record that aren't there, but that email is there. This provision of the contract is there, and our provision of the complaint is there. Then to address the broader issue in my last 3.5 minutes here, if it is true that this contract ended on September 30th, then what was the point of the relationship between attorney and Civil Society will change to an hourly fee contract? What was the point of that? The attorneys would all be fired, the contract would be over, and there would be no reason for that provision. You have to give the plain meaning to that, and what is the meaning of that? I don't think we can assume that the drafters of this contract just put that in there for no good reason. Second of all, and Mr. Snyder has argued this, you know, on up the line, that somehow I and Ms. Flagg had to withdraw from these cases. They're not our cases. They were never our clients. They were Civil Society's client in any fair reading of this contract. And I've pointed this out from the first paragraph that says, you know, attorneys' desires to provide services to Civil Society, to Civil Society, and Civil Society's desires that attorneys provide such services to Civil Society. We weren't providing these services to the clients. These were their clients. Under this federal funding, and they're not legal services, but you know, there's a statute on legal services corporations and on and on. But these were their clients. If anyone had an obligation, if they were shutting down, they had, it had, the Civil Society board, its executive director, somebody, had the obligation to go to the court. It is not the, when a law firm shuts down, I can assure you, those individual lawyers who get the street aren't continuing on those cases. That firm had an obligation, and those firms take care of those cases. They could have easily done this, but they didn't give notice until after, well after September 30th, the written notice that they were required to give. And apparently—
Why would they have to give written notice?
Because the contract says they do. They have to give us written notice.
The contract also says that it ends on September 30th, 2022.
I understand that, Your Honor. That's an ambiguity. There are ambiguities or—
ended as an ambiguity?
I don't know, cross. There are conflicts in this contract. But they did give the notice, and I think that's in the record somewhere. But my point is, if they were there, there's been an interpretation by the lower court that Mr. Snyder has argued that it was the attorney, the employee's obligations to get out of these cases or to represent them for free or do something. I never signed, and there is nothing in this record that's been presented by Civil Society, especially if you're looking this under a Rule 56. They've never produced a retainer agreement of me to any of these Civil Society clients I was representing because none exists. The retainer agreements, which you don't have because of the way this case is before you on the Rule 1203, are signed with Civil Society, and this contract talks about that in all its provisions. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thank you to both counsel. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.
Thank you.